the buzz? Tell me what's happening. What's 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 the buzz? It's the Week in Review on KUOW. I'm David Hyde in for Bill Radke. And in case you missed it, maybe you were at the beach, there was a historic election this week in Seattle. Voters got to try out council districts for the first time. Not many people turned out, though, still behind a projected 30% in King County. But these results could change the face of the city, take us in new directions, perhaps radical new directions, especially when it comes to the future of housing. And one of the people here today to help us sort it out, C.R. Douglas. He's a political analyst at Q13. C.R., let's get right to it. What's the number one issue for you in this election?
Well, the number one issue clearly in Seattle was housing density, housing affordability, zoning, that whole kind of space became what this election was about. I mean, ever since the mayor dropped that housing task force a couple weeks ago, this was all basically that was being talked about. And there were three camps in the kind of housing affordability discussion in this election. The mayor and his allies, who basically wanted to kind of push the pedal of density, get a lot more units, upzone, do some kind of intriguing things with developers to get some affordable housing.
Not destroy single-family zoning, but make some changes.
But push the pedal on density. That camp did pretty well. The second camp that also did pretty well is typified by Shama Sawant. And their platform is not anti-density. Their platform is basically the same kind of unit goals as the mayor, that kind of thing. They differ, however, in how much they want to require of developers to pay for that density and especially to pay for the affordable housing. A number of races, the candidates with that profile won. And then the third camp, which did not do well, and I think won't play a big factor in the general election, is the sort of NIMBY, anti-density, put the pedals on growth, going too fast, we're ruining character. There was that in many of these races, but it did not win, and it didn't certainly win big even where it did come through the primary. So the big thing in November in these council races is going to be, what burden do you put on the private sector versus the public sector in creating affordable housing?
How do you characterize that third camp? Is it the neighborhood movement, an anti-urbanist movement?
Yeah, I think that's fair. You know, NIMBY, if you want to kind of put it in one acronym. I mean, there is a community out there that thinks we're going too fast and that we're ruining the character of Seattle.
And they rose up in Ballard recently talking about another issue, which was tent cities, but it's the same kind of political forces you're talking about. They did not do well in this election.
They did not do well in this election.
And this election is about how much pain do we want to... The general election is going to be about how much pain do we want to give developers moving forward when it comes to the issue, at least, of affordable housing.
Yeah, and basically the Sawant camp, which you're going to hear a lot from, are folks that want to really be hard on developers and make them pay a big price. You'll use that money for affordable housing. They want rent control, which is in effect another fee on developers by capping profits. And that camp will be loud versus kind of the mayor's camp, which isn't going to be as hard on developers, that's going to kind of spread the burden.
All right. Democrat Pramila Jayapal is also with us. She's with us by phone because there's some terrible traffic out there, as I understand it. She represents South Seattle in the Washington State Senate. Pramila Jayapal, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. And we did put $15 billion into transportation so that we can fix these kinds of things. But yes,
in the future, I can hear you. What do you think voters in Seattle especially were saying about affordable housing this election?
Well, look, I disagree slightly with CR in that I don't think the election was just about affordable housing. I think what we see is an electorate that is moving left beyond where perhaps our electeds have been on a number of issues, and it is affordable housing. It's affordability overall, which includes issues of wages and jobs. And fundamentally, I think it's really about what does Seattle look like? Who gets to live here? Who's going to represent those people? Who makes the decisions about working people in this city? And that's really what I saw in the election. Affordable housing is a piece of that. Certainly was the issue that was covered the most. But I think that this has to do with everything from, you know, sort of climate change, shell activism, as well as affordable housing, as well as, you know, I think Shama's race, Shama Sawant's race, was also a bit of a test or a referendum. Can we elect, re-elect a socialist city council member who some have said is very divisive, who pushed along with others for the $15 minimum wage? Is she re-electable? Is Seattle going to move in that direction? And certainly affordable housing is a piece of
that. And we're going to be digging into some, if not all, of those issues today. Just on this question of how divided the city is, though, right now, I mean, how much rage do you see in these election results?
Well, I do see a lot of I see a lot of anger, but I also see a lot of hope. I think that, you know, obviously the low turnout is not hopeful, but the reality is that in races where there were real races, if you look at the districts, Shama Sawant's district had, I think, the highest turnout. I think Mike O'Brien's district also was up there. And I think that people in districts where there were, you know, where there was somebody that they were excited about and they felt like there was a real contest saw the highest turnout. So I see anger, but I also see a lot of possibility. People feel good about the idea of having a voice in Seattle and being able to have the electeds represent the electorate, which usually that trails. You know, usually I think the electorate is usually far ahead of the electeds in terms of politics most of the time.
Also with us today, Chris Vance. He's a public affairs consultant, former chair of the state Republican Party. Chris Vance, how you doing?
Making progress, almost past the accident now.
All right, great. Also news, there's an accident on I-5. What is this affordable housing debate really about?
I think it's a metaphor for the issue that Senator Jayapal was talking about, and that is what is the future of Seattle? I mean, most voters have housing. Most voters are pretty comfortable, and so they're not concerned about affordable housing for themselves, perhaps for their kids or their grandkids. But it's a metaphor for this whole debate about, is Seattle going to become just a place where rich yuppies can live? Which I think is probably the biggest undercurrent in Seattle city politics right now. It symbolizes a lot of other issues. But I would say it's hard to say people are really, really angry when they don't turn out to vote. The turnout was exceptionally low. And I think that indicates that, as interesting as this is, it hasn't really captured the attention of voters.
All right, C.R. Douglas, back to you. How divided do you think the city is heading into the general election, especially on this question of affordable housing?
I think it's pretty divided. I don't think the rage level is huge. I would agree with Chris Vance on that.
But what about his point just about this anxiety about the city becoming a place just for rich yuppies? I've been here since 2004. It seems like we've been talking about that in Seattle since at least then. I don't know, forever maybe. How much of that is kind of coming to a head right now?
I think it absolutely is. And I think it's typified by the Mayor's Housing Affordability Task Force, where you had, for the first time really, a kind of tipping point for this affordability. Yes, we've been talking about it for a long time, but not until that housing task force came out with pretty extreme recommendations. I mean, huge unit goals, huge attempts to build affordable housing units, huge changes to some of the you know, long traditions in the city in terms of zoning. I mean, they wouldn't have gone that far. They wouldn't have gone so big had there not been something in the water here that says we've got to finally deal with this issue.
All right. You're listening to The Week in Review here on KUOW. It's The Week in Review on KUOW, and we're talking about the big election this week. Seattle voters had their first shot at council districts, and Lynn Parker was at the Cowan Park block party in the University District on Tuesday night.
Well, I think it's a good thing because I think it'll be good to have more neighborhood representation, you know, and we have a very strong, cohesive neighborhood, and so it'd be nice to have somebody who gets us and fights for our values and all that.
So, C.R. Douglas, that enthusiasm's out there. There were reports of more doorbelling, more retail politics, more excitement. And you'd think with an election like that, that people would get out to vote. What happened?
Well, it's an off-year election. And every 4 years, we kind of grind through a really low turnout year. I mean, it's a year with no president on the ballot, no governor on the ballot, no senators on the ballot. Locally, there's no county executive on the ballot. There's no competitive mayor's race. I mean, none of those things, which typically draw voters, no initiative, no bag ban, no parks district. I mean, the only thing really going with the energy were these district races. But that's just not enough. We have these every 4 years. It just happens, and you move on.
What about Pramila Jayapal, State Senator Pramila Jayapal, the fact that the economy is doing relatively well, and when people aren't mad, they don't necessarily turn out to vote? There are some issues in this race, but what about that question?
No, I think actually when people are really, you know, I think when people are doing really well, they may turn out to vote because they want to keep it that way, or they may not. I don't think that there's any. I think CR is right. There's no real science behind this. I do think we have to do a lot of work to reach people who don't vote, because each time we're slicing off more and more of the electorate. And if you look at how political campaigns are structured, they tend to be structured around likely voters. So every time the slice that we're talking to is getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And I know, for example, in my campaign last year, we focused on people who weren't voting and we got turnout up, even though it was dismally low, you know, across the country. I think that's what we have to start doing, is talking to people who don't vote regularly. Because I don't know about you, but I get inundated by those mailers. I don't look at half of them. The people that would look at them are the people that don't get them typically.
Hmm. C.R. Douglas, incumbent Gene Godden conceded last night. How do you think the new district system and perhaps this voter turnout issue affected her race?
I think it killed her. I think Gene Godden actually would have done better in an at-large race. So she is a casualty of this move to district. She's a casualty of the fact that two folks who were not very well known, who didn't have much money, were able to really doorbell and kind of shoe leather this thing. It's the end of an era for Gene Godden. She probably pushed her luck one term too many. She's been on the council for 12 years. But listen.
Who was Gene Godden for folks who don't know?
Gene Godden was a longtime civic activist in this community for years. I mean, a 50-plus, nearly 60-year career here, which spanned journalism, community activism, and then for her last 12 years as a leader on the Seattle City Council. She ought to be proud of walking off the stage right now in what she has done. She's the last, really, of that World War II generation in power in this region. She stuck with it a long time. She has a lot of accomplishments, and she goes out probably not how she wanted.
Yeah.
But still quite a legacy.
I mean, I agree that Jean has done some wonderful things, you know, in her career, both in the legislature, you know, in elected office and outside. And I think she was a strong fighter on a lot of women's issues when other people weren't speaking up about those. But I do think that I don't know if she would have won in an at-large election. I'm not sure, because she did not always seem to know, you know, she didn't have a great performance in her debates. And I think people looked at that and said, look, it's time for a change. She doesn't really seem to know what's going on. She made some funny statements that I don't think comported with her career necessarily. And I think it was time to see some fresh blood there in that race. And I think both the candidates that we have are excellent for that particular district. I think we have a really great choice there.
So Seattle's losing a pioneer, a woman both in journalism and in politics.
Yeah, but we're going to have a majority of women on the council, younger,
Could
more
happen.
Diverse.
first female majority since 1999.
I mean, I am just, you know, so excited about this because, no offense here, guys, but I really do think that we're, you know, we have a really wonderful range of women who are going to be able to take into account a lot of issues. Don't forget, women make up a majority of the electorate as well, but we've never been represented in that way. And I think that we'll see really strong proposals on, you know, issues that affect families and working families. So, and more diverse too. I mean, we're going to have our first Latina. I'm pretty convinced of that. Maybe we'll have two. And we're going to have, obviously, continue to have, I think, a South Asian council member as well. And so I think this is really exciting for Seattle and younger, which is also important.
CR, how is this new system playing into this?
Well, I think it's creating these dynamics. I mean, there was some discussion after the election and even leading up to it, the districts weren't changing anything. There's still money in this and all the rest. I disagree. I think in the four competitive districts, actually really the three competitive ones, I want to take out Shamas because I think that's a different animal, but in the three competitive districts, West Seattle, North Seattle, Northeast Seattle, that Godden district, all the finalists, except maybe one, except maybe Sandy Brown, all those finalists are people that I don't think would have run in at-large seats. I don't think they would have done well in at-large seats. They wouldn't have raised nearly as much money for at-large seats. And they're lefties more than an at-large council.
No.
So this has created a very different council.
So more retail politics, more diversity, at least as much, if not more, money, actually. So that didn't happen. And it remains to be seen how it's going to affect turnout. Is that a fair summary?
I think so. But, you know, I know we're talking about Seattle, but I think on districts, it's important also to look at Yakima. It's a very important,
good point,
very important place where the Federal Voting Rights Act came into play. And because of that, Yakima moved to district elections. And we are going to have two Latino candidates,
right,
that have made it through.
Although Seattle didn't move to district elections for the same reason, and yet we may just end up with that result.
Well, Seattle didn't move to district elections for the same reason, but we couldn't really show polarized voting here if we tried. I mean, I think that has not been the history in Seattle.
I just want to say one thing about money in the districts. Yes, there was a lot more independent expenditure money, but if you put that to aside for a second, The Lisa Herbolts, the Shannon Braddocks over in the first district, the Michael Maddox, the Rob Johnsons who are winning in Northeast, even the fifth district in North Seattle, they're at the sort of 80,000 mark. I mean, it used to be it took 250,000 to run a competitive race. Well, Rob Johnson gets in first, beats Gene Godden with $80,000. Now, he had some help from independent expenditures, but there's actually less direct money in the winning campaigns than there has been in the at-large system.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, the district election makes it easier for people to run with less money in the direct races, but it does also make it easier for independent expenditures to make a difference in a race because you're working with a smaller pot, right? So if you're only if the candidate is only spending $80,000 in a district election, that means somebody else, independent expenditure, can spend $100,000, which you couldn't do in an at-large seat and still make a difference. So, you know, you got a little bit of both, and I think we really need campaign finance and transparency in order to really level the playing field more.
All right. For State Senator Pramila Jayapal and C.R. Douglas, it's a win-win-win. You're listening to The Week in Review on KUOW. It's The Week in Review on KUOW, and there was a time when calling yourself a socialist was the kiss of death in American politics. But this week, Seattle's most famous city council member, socialist Shama Sawant, got 50%, over 50% so far in her reelection bid. Also this week, Democratic socialist presidential candidate Bernie Sanders is coming to town. So socialism is no longer apparently a dirty word in American politics, at least not here in Seattle. State Senator Pramila Jayapal, it must be said you formally endorsed Shama Sawant and other candidates in this election. But what do you think? Is Seattle turning socialist?
Look, I think these are just labels in my mind. I think what you have to look at is what are the policies. And, you know, I got a lot of grief for being a Democrat who endorsed a socialist, and people were, you know, some people were up in arms. And I said, look, I look at what the policies are. Are there, I mean, just like we go into the legislature and we're expected to work with Republicans who believe, you know, some of the same things we do. So I'm looking at who is going to forward the policies that I care about. And to me, that's Shama. I think that there was a big hue and cry about how she's divisive. And I've said before that I wouldn't necessarily say all the same things she does. But that to me does not outweigh what she is actually doing, which is, first of all, advancing very important policies for the city of Seattle. And secondly, I think bringing in an electorate, you cannot overlook the fact that her district got the most turnout of anybody, and it was still low, but you know, I think the reality is she is engaging young people, and she is engaging people of color who have felt disenfranchised, and that is very, very important. So, you know, can we vote for a socialist and still survive? Absolutely. And Bernie Sanders is a socialist, but he's running as a Democrat,
right?
And
Democrat,
so
and socialist.
He is. Yeah.
Sierra Douglas, how well did Shama Sawant do this week?
I think she did very well. I mean, listen, she gets over 50%. That's better than Tim Burgess. That's better than Gene Godden.
That's right.
And she had the best funded opponent of anyone in the entire race. And listen, primary voters, let's face it, are not her demographic. I mean, primary voters sort of skew older. They skew whiter. They skew homeowner. She does well with renters and kids, right? And they turn out for general elections. They basically don't turn out for primary elections. So that she's getting 50%+ in a primary election bodes well for November. If you look back at 2013, when she was first elected, she surged between the primary and the general election. Got she, like 35% in the primary, gets 51% in the general.
She did, right? But Pamela Banks is her challenger. She's about where Shama Sawant was in that election, right? Who's Pamela Banks? What are her chances?
Well, right. So I don't say this race is over. Pamela Banks is a very compelling candidate, you know, leader in the African-American community. But the why I think Shama should be happy about this result, not that she can't be taken out, but she's now a clear polarizing figure. She's now, you know, angered a lot of people. There are a lot of people that hate her that didn't in 2013. So even with all that and getting over 50%, I mean, she's never going to get 60%. This is not a candidate that's going to run away with any election like some of the other incumbents. It's always going to be tough given how polarizing she is. But to do this well in the primary, I think is happy news if you're Shama people.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think, you know, I've known Pamela for a long time. She's a great person. She's got good politics. I think that this, though, and you try to find ways to tell you what a candidate's going to be like after they get into office. And one of the ways to do that is to look at contributions. And so that was a lot of what was put out there. But I think the reality is 17 points ahead in a primary election.
I want to get a little off this race and back to the original question. Is Seattle going socialist? CR, what do you think?
I don't think it's going socialist. I think it's going more progressive. I think it's going more left. I think Shama sort of has helped that, but I think Shama has also reflected that.
That's right.
I mean, I think if you look at the minimum wage, I think if you look at the conversation on housing affordability, I think if you look at kind of her talk about a millionaire's tax, which is not absolutely totally crazy in the city of Seattle, I think those kinds of things are becoming more of the norm. So the center, if you will, is moving left. But listen, Seattle is not going to go for all of Shama's socialism. Seattle is not going to nationalize Boeing and some of the other things she has talked
Collectivize
about.
Collectivize Amazon workers.
There are limits.
Chris Vance is here.
You saw it, I think, even with Jeff Speer's election. It's not like any socialist runs and wins. People look at who the candidate is. What are they saying? Do they reflect the values? It's less about, I mean, I think it's push from both sides, right? It's a push from the electorate to move left on a number of things. They like the fact that somebody's calling out what is true in their minds. And then on the other side, it's Shama bringing a platform in for people to really say, okay, do we believe in this?
All right. Fortunately, the former head of the state Republican Party, Chris Vance, is with us. And I want to go to you and ask you this question. If you think the consensus seems to be, no, Seattle's not necessarily going socialist, but it's moving further to the left, What do you think?
I don't think there is anything to the left of Seattle other than socialism, because Seattle has always been incredibly liberal. And I look, I don't live here, which is self-evident by the fact that I can't get here on time. I live in Auburn. I was born in Seattle. I love Seattle. I mean, I think it's terrible when suburban Republicans and rural Republicans attack Seattle. But
you're going to do it.
No, I'm not. But the truth is, Seattle is an incredibly liberal city, far outside the mainstream of American politics. And it's becoming more liberal.
What's your evidence for that? Is Washington State not going more socialist, Chris Vance?
Absolutely not. I mean, Republicans control the Senate. Republicans, after this election, we should talk about the election in Federal Way, where in a special election in the primary, the Republican, Terry Hickel, is leading the appointed Democrat. It looks like the Republicans are going to pick up another seat in the House, which will bring the House to 50 to 48. People have gotten used to the idea that Frank Chop has a big majority in the legislature. He doesn't.
It is a slim majority, but I'm
not
so sure.
And the Republicans are going to pick up this seat. When you look across the country, and this is so jarring because when you're a Republican in King County or Seattle, you feel like a minority. But Republicans control the U.S. House, the U.S. Senate, 30 out of 50 governors, and two-thirds of all state legislatures. America is becoming more conservative, while Seattle is approaching the very edge of, you know, what's acceptable in the left.
Well, I would say that I think we have to be a little bit careful about what's conservative and what's left, because $15, you know, a higher minimum wage, let's say $12, is an extremely popular proposal in Republican states, in Democratic states, across the country. And so you can't say that going to a higher minimum wage, for example, is a left policy anymore. It's
yeah,
not.
Yes, I can.
You can from an elected official standpoint, because I'll tell you, if the Republicans don't move forward with increases in minimum wage, it will get done at the ballot initiative by the people. And the same thing is true of raising taxes. You saw several conservative states across the country raised the gas tax, for example.
Well, that's Republicans will support funding for infrastructure. That's not socialism. I'm not here to attack Seattle. People need to understand how unusual Seattle is.
All right. What I'm hearing is we're getting a more divided city and we're getting a more divided state when it comes to left and right. You're listening to The Week in Review on KUOW. It's the Week in Review on KUOW, and the poor Port of Seattle had an election, too. Nobody seems to pay that much attention to the Port of Seattle, even though its operating revenues are over $500 million, unless Shell Oil tries to bring a vessel here, and then people do seem to pay attention. C.R. Douglas, what was at stake in the Port of Seattle race, do you think?
I think people did pay attention to it this year. I think that's the only way you can interpret the results, because I think Courtney Gregoire didn't have a challenge. So it's really the second race, that open seat, that's the one to talk about. Mm. And the kind of maritime industry backed very heavily one candidate, well over $100,000. And that candidate, Darrell Bryan, crashed and burned. And the two candidates that made it through were progressives, anti-Shell, don't want that Arctic drilling fleet, want the port to be more environmental. I mean, the fact that two, and not just one, of the progressives made it through suggests that people were paying attention, and there was a kind of anti-Shell backlash that I think showed up in that result.
What's at stake environmentally for the port? I mean, the Shell issue doesn't really affect Seattle. Seattle's moved in a fairly environmental direction by asking, for example, cruise ships to plug in when they're at the port. That was a major new initiative so that we didn't have these smokestacks basically along our port polluting the city as much as we did in the past. What are the environmental issues, and are we going to move in some kind of radical environmental direction at the port? What do you think?
The Port of Seattle's job is to be a port, not to advance social agendas or social policies. And this is, if we start limiting the port's ability to compete for business because we find it, whatever they're doing, you know, doesn't fit our social norms or philosophy, we're going to take another step towards down the road where Seattle's no longer a working port that creates tens of thousands of good union wage jobs that supposedly liberals want, and nothing but a waterfront with Ferris wheels and fish and chips. I mean, I'm sorry, the port needs to compete for business, and that includes stuff that people may find they don't particularly like.
Well, so, I think the election, though, is actually a little bit it's challenging a little bit of what Chris is saying, because I think people understand that the port has to be a good working port, and it is true that the majority of jobs at the port are good union jobs. But the reality is climate change and the effects of the port's business on climate change are absolutely real and critically important. And that's true not just in terms of the, you know, sort of very high profile Shell drilling, but it's also true in terms of emissions of the port. And there's been a lot of work and activism. It's not nearly as sexy, but done on sort of the emissions of the trucks that come in and out of the mm-hmm. port and what that should be. There's been a lot of controversy around short haul truck drivers out of the port, and the fact that they're not even earning minimum wage because they're independent contractors. Most of them are immigrants. I know I did a lot of work on this when I was at One America, and that. So there are a lot of issues that the port still needs to address, including, by the way, minimum wage. And you know, I think you could argue that the port commissioners have not had the kind of power that maybe they could or should. And so the real question is, are the port commissioners as a group going to exert more power over the day-to-day operations of the port, or is it still going to be run primarily by corporations and by the staff?
Yeah, I don't know what the numbers are, but if you include all the shipping, all the trucks, and all the planes coming in and out of SeaTac, I mean, the emissions in terms of climate change in our region, it's got to be the biggest, one of the biggest sources, maybe the biggest source. Well, C.R. Douglas, though.
No, that's not true.
Is it not?
It's power plants. It's the oil refineries.
In our region, Seattle, we don't really have. Yeah. We've got two
submarines. In King County, again, absolutely.
If we get the port wrapped up in climate change politics, the port is simply going to lose business to other ports. Are going to say, great, you know, you guys become politically correct, we'll take your jobs.
But here's the thing, Republicans continue to act as if climate change is this other outside socialist agenda. The reality is climate change is part of business, and you have people like our former Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson saying, you know, business has to come to terms with the fact that this is a part of business. This is a Republican former Secretary of Treasury.
But how much can Seattle go it alone when, as Chris Vance says, there's Vancouver, there's California,
there's other ports.
They're just going to take the business.
That's exactly what will happen.
Listen, we have continued to try to. There are lots of ways to address climate change issues, both at the state and locally. Republicans have continued to not do that. But bringing it back to the port, I think there are all kinds of things that the port can do to address these issues of emissions. And let's just look at the fact that in White Center and places where, you know, the port where the emissions are the highest, it's kids of color who are getting asthma at the highest possible rates. This is absolutely a community issue. It is not something that's sort of out there. And, you know, we can't set this up as some people on the other side continue to do, as sort of a good for business versus just a, you know, kind of it's not going to do anything. This is about how do we make public policy integrated in terms of the effects on communities, jobs, and business.
C.R. Douglas, that's the debate. What do you think is going to happen in terms of the city turning in a direction, as Chris Vance says, that may be making a choice that's anti-business, even if it's pro-environment? Is it going to go that far?
Well, I mean, we'll see. Seattle is testing a lot of limits. And going back to this idea of has it gotten more liberal and progressive, I think absolutely. I mean, I think it's unquestionable. I think Mayor Murray is more liberal than Mayor McGinn was. Mayor McGinn was more liberal than Mayor Nichols was. Mayor Nichols was more liberal than Mayor Rice. I think you're getting the port moving in the direction of being more liberal. The sort of 3-2 block now after this election is going to be sort of pro-environment in the port as opposed to pro-business. But I do think at some point it can cost you jobs and it can affect your economy. So this is a pendulum. It will not go this way forever. It will start coming back.
And one quick thing on the port, because I think it's important. When I was in the legislature, I do think that some of my colleagues who are outside of Seattle Senator Roach, I know, is one who talked about this to me. Senator Warnick, also talked about this to me. You know, it is true that while we get to vote on the port affects people across the state. And I do think I have a new understanding of that. And I do think it is incumbent on us to think about the fact that the port does serve all those orchards on the east side. And we do have to think about sort of the whole state. But the reality is voters in Seattle determine the port.
Voters in King County determine the port. People, two-thirds of the people in King County don't live in Seattle.
All right. Well, and it's even more significant what the results were, because it was still a more progressive candidate, two progressive candidates, as CR said, that made it through.
But the theme that emerged here is the theme I've been hearing this whole hour, which is the port two is moving a little bit further left. You're listening to The Week in Review on KUOW. It's the Week in Review on KUOW. I'm David Hyde in for Bill Radke. And the first official Republican debates were last night.
I don't trust President Obama with our records. I know you gave him a big hug. And if you want to give him a big hug again, go right ahead.
And you know, Senator Paul, you know, the hugs that I remember are the hugs that I gave to the families who lost their people on September 11th. Those are the hugs I remember. And those had nothing to do with politics.
It was heated. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie and Kentucky Senator Rand Paul, Chris Vance, former head of the Washington State Republican Party, based on their performance last night or based on things that you know, who's the right Republican for Washington State?
Well, what was jarring, though, is that and I found a little disconcerting, is the candidates up there were running as far to the right as they could, as fast as they can, trying to appeal to the base. One of these people is going to have to come back to the center and talk to more centrist voters. Running for president is a marathon, and this is a very early type debate. A lot of these folks are not going to make it past Iowa or New Hampshire. I think that the folks up there who could win and could compete here in Washington State were the governors. Governor Bush, Governor Kasich, and Governor Christie. They're the ones who were talking, had the most specifics, the most realistic answers. I loved Governor Christie's answer on Social Security and how what it's really going to take to save Social Security.
And is it fair to say they're the most moderate, the most economic conservative as opposed to social conservatives?
Labels are not a good thing.
Okay.
But yeah,
it's
yes.
The no labels.
If you really want to make it simple, yes, they're the more moderate candidates. And I think that along with Scott Walker, those four are going to end up being the ones who seriously compete for this nomination.
What did you hear last night? I heard a lot of issues being discussed and really interesting questions, tough questions. But what were the issues, or what is the issue you think that might appeal to Washington State voters?
This election is all about the economy. That is the issue. Millions of Americans struggling in an economy that's still not creating enough good middle-class jobs. The gap between rich and poor is widening. We're $18 trillion in debt. Social Security and Medicare are on the road to insolvency. Those are the issues. Once we get past talking about who is the most pro-life and who's going to be the toughest on immigrants and get past all those issues that appeal to this tiny fraction of the base, it's the economy that's going to matter to voters.
And I heard Governor Kasich of Ohio trumpeting triumphantly, talking about how great the economy is doing there. How's it going to play out?
You've got three governors up there who have been elected in big, diverse states who know how to win in not a purely red Republican state. And that's Jeb Bush, John Kasich, and Chris Christie. And Scott Walker, to some extent, although his record is different. That's why those guys, I think, eventually will be – the cream will rise to the top.
All right. C.R. Douglas, we heard the governors. What about Donald Trump? He seems popular, and he's definitely outspoken.
I think the big problem this country has is being politically correct. I've been challenged by so many people, and I don't frankly have time for total political correctness.
C.R. Douglas, who is the right Republican for Washington State?
Well, I don't think it's Donald Trump. I think he had a bad night. even if he had a good night, I don't think he would have done well in Washington. If you look at the history of Washington and the sort of Republican nominees, I mean, Ron Paul has done very well. He hasn't won, but he's done very well. Mm. So I meant, yeah, Ron. And so Rand, the son, probably will benefit from that if he's in long enough.
Why?
Because there is a kind of libertarian streak in Washington, and it's not a majority, but it shows up pretty heavily. It has showed up for Ron Paul in the last two election cycles. But at the end of the day, Washington goes for the more moderate. So in 2012, it went for Mitt Romney. In 2008, the last competitive year, it went for John McCain. I mean, the sort of establishment moderates who are more on the fiscal side and not on the social issue side. I think probably a Jeb Bush, you know, would be the right profile for Washington Republicans.
The last time we had a competitive Republican primary, presidential primary that mattered, George W. Bush won it, not the more conservative candidates. And John McCain came in second. So people love to talk about the Republican base, but when it comes right down to it, the Republican voters are far more centrist.
Yeah, the Rand Paul thing though is interesting.
And
what,
everywhere
what
else.
Do you think about that? Rand Paul and Chris Christie had
Alabama.
Rand Paul and Chris Christie had a really interesting exchange last night over the question of the collection of phone records and civil liberties. CR saying that's the kind of thing that could play here in Washington State.
I think it does. I mean, I certainly saw it in the legislature on a lot of civil liberties bills. You had kind of extreme left and extreme right coming together on those bills, and I think that is that was an interesting thing to watch, little clip to watch, and I think CR's right on that piece. I think, you know, Chris knows his base here really well. I think that sounds absolutely right to me in terms of who might make it through. You know, I joked and said, you know, which candidate is right for Washington State? They're all too right for Washington State. I mean, this is not a state that has tended to go for a Republican candidate as a winner. But I think that I think it's a good thing that there's a lot of candidates in that race. I thought the debate last night, Fox may have been trying to set up the idea that Donald Trump is wrong for the race, because it does divide the party. And if you look at even the focus group thing that they did afterwards, I kept thinking, oh, wow, this is all a setup to make sure people understand how bad Donald Trump is.
It seems like he stole the show, but it was hard to know how seriously to take that. Chris Vance, I'm wondering, you know, if Hillary Clinton is the presumptive nominee on the Democratic side, how many independents and maybe even Democrats who voted for Barack Obama might be looking at this Republican field? In our state,
people have opinions and there's facts. And if you look at the polling data, Hillary Clinton's numbers are eroding rapidly. And she's got some and again, it's not my opinion. It's looking at the data. She's got some personal problems. Personal meaning that when you poll on asking about likability and trustworthiness and is someone telling the truth, those numbers are falling apart for her. I think there's a lot of people who just assume that she's going to be a very strong candidate. But there's a lot of political professionals who believe that the same things that caused her to lose to Barack Obama make her a very flawed candidate.
Where does she do well in Washington State, and where does she do poorly, do you think? Because this was an Obama state last time around.
Well, if you take away the city of Seattle, Washington is a Republican state. The Democratic votes are in Seattle and a few other places like downtown Spokane and downtown Vancouver. And in a statewide race, that's enough to win.
Among Democratic voters.
I'm not sure she's liberal enough for the base Democratic voters in Washington State. I think Bernie Sanders. Now, here's something to remember. The Democrats are going to choose their delegates by a pure caucus and convention process. That process favors the more liberal candidate. Bernie Sanders is probably going to be very formidable in Washington State's caucus and convention system.
State Senator Pramila Jayapal, what do you think of that?
I think that's true. I think that Bernie Sanders will do well. I think people are concerned about some of the things that Chris has raised. But I also think that in the end, people rally around who the ultimate Democratic nominee is. And I think if Hillary Clinton is the ultimate Democratic nominee, it doesn't, you know, I think it will bring out people. She will do well. People will understand the difference between even a Hillary Clinton presidency and a Kasich or Scott Walker or Jeb Bush presidency. And I think that will turn out the Democratic vote in Washington State.
If Bernie Sanders does do well here, does that make any difference? Does he have a chance?
He doesn't have a chance. I mean, he's gonna do well here. But listen, there's a kind of ceiling for a candidate like that, a protest candidate, if you will. I think it's still Hillary's nomination, but I do think there is this issue. Can she recreate the Obama coalition? And I think that's going to be tough
there,
for her.
There was a moment last night. Rand Paul said something really important that most people didn't notice. And he talked about how in many, many swing states like Colorado and I think in Virginia and others, he's leading Hillary Clinton in the polls now. That's true. If you look at it, she's fallen behind all the leading Republicans in many swing states. Democrats should be very worried about that.
Yeah, but I think that the thing is we're still a long ways from the election. So much stuff happens very quickly. I don't think that the polls at this point tell us very much, frankly. I think it's going to get down much closer to the election, and we're going to have, I think, a good competition on our hands.
All right. Pramila Jayapal gets the last word on that one. You're listening to The Week in Review here on KUOW. Three months ago, the CEO of Gravity Payments, which is based here in Seattle, raised wages for all its employees to $70,000 a year. And the CEO's name is Dan Price.
Between having an awesome vacation house in Vail and having everybody make $70,000 or more, I can guarantee I'd rather choose the latter.
He's gotten a lot of praise for this, but also some criticism, including by two of his employees, at least two of his most valued, quit, according to a New York Times story this week. They said it's unfair to double the pay for some new hires when people have been there for a really long time or getting no raises or really kind of teeny raises. Pramila Jayapal, what do you think of Dan Price's decision?
Well, I think he's raising two very important points that we frankly haven't talked a lot about in the minimum wage debate. Number one, he's looking at overall cost of living. What does somebody need to earn in order to be able to live? So he's not talking about a set minimum wage in an hourly context. He's talking about it in terms of a salary. And that is a very important shift that I think we are going to see the conversation move to even beyond the hourly minimum.
So he may be somewhat changing the conversation by raising this, by doing this. But if you work for him and you make $70,000 a year and suddenly, you know, the person who was an intern last week is suddenly making $70,000 a year too, how do you feel about that?
Well, I think there's going to be some shifts and changes in how people have to think about this.
Yeah, but what would you say to that employee?
Great. I mean, but look at who I am. I mean, that's my politics. I think the second thing that Dan Price did is he addressed this issue of the gap between CEO pay and worker pay.
Yeah.
And that is huge. And that's a top question across the country. And I think that he is a brave man for doing this. And he's seen some criticism, but he's also seen a lot more clients coming in. Different. He's lost some. He's gained some. There's going to be a shift. There's going to be a lot of people pulling for him to both succeed and maybe some to fail.
Chris Vance, is it fair?
No, of course it's not fair. And, you know, I was a political science major at Western Washington University a long, long time ago. And even back then, you'd be in poli-sci classes, and the big question is, why doesn't America have a socialist party?
Why is there no socialism in America?
Because Americans don't want to be socialists. Americans don't look at a rich man or a rich woman and say, let's pull them down. They say, I want to be rich too. Americans are strivers and climbers. Americans are competitive, and they want to get rich. And that's why class warfare doesn't work in this country and never has. And that's why socialism is never. Well, it's just not part of America's character. And that's why it'll never take hold. Americans want to compete and get ahead.
Well, sure, Americans want to compete, but they want to know that they can compete. And we are now in a phase of history where the United States myth that you can actually make it up the ladder is dissolving very quickly. And every single Republican candidate is talking about income inequality
because I would agree with the
majority of the country is demanding that we address this gap between the 1% and the 99%.
All right, Sierra Douglas, you have the last word on this one. Does it make you happier if everybody's making $70,000 a year?
No.
What?
And that's part of the problem with
why?
This. Because if you're the guy that's been there for, you know, 5 years, you've got skills, you've got seniority, and suddenly the entry-level guy is making the same, that's a problem. This is the fundamental problem with the minimum wage hike. Not saying it's bad, but it's not just about hiking the minimum wage. When you do it, you basically have to hike everyone else's wage. And it is more of a cost to a business than just the entry-level worker.
What's your evidence for that?
Gravity Payments. I mean, he cannot keep this without raising some of the pay of those who were at 70 already.
And he may do that.
And he may do that. And listen, a lot of restaurants, they have talked about, Tom Douglas talked about this a lot. It's going to ratchet up everyone's wages. It has to, by human
which
needs.
Which isn't necessarily a bad thing.
I'm just saying it's a bigger cost than just the minimum wage.
The senator's right in that the gap between rich and poor is growing, and we need to store the minimum wage. I mean, the ability for Americans to rise. But the way you do that is by getting government off the back of businesses and cutting taxes and letting them grow and create better jobs for everyone.
All right. The theme that emerged this week, growing inequality, concern about affordability, and some big differences of opinion about how we solve those problems. Our guest this week on The Week in Review, C.R. Douglas. He's a political analyst at KCPQ 13 Fox. Pramil Jayapal, Democratic State Senator representing South Seattle. Chris Vance, political consultant and former Republican State Party Chair. Thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
You bet.
Thank you.
Jason Pagano's our producer. I'm David Hyde. Bill Radke will be back here next week. Thanks for listening.